Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 6, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleform conference call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing the oral arguments of Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado CRC, heard in the Supreme Court today. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Kim Colby, Director at the Center for Legal and Religious Freedom at the Christian Legal Society. After opening remarks from Kim, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Kim. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. And thank you for providing this teleforum to update listeners on the oral argument that happened this morning in the United States Supreme Court in Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. I just should say at the beginning, it was a well-attended argument. I arrived at the court at 5:45 a.m., and if I had been a minute or two later, I would not have gotten into the courtroom. The line was that long, so it has a great deal of interest. It's considered one of the most important cases of the 2017 term, and it may well determine whether we live in a pluralistic society that protects religious dissenters or a less free society that suppresses religious dissenters who dare challenge government orthodoxy. I believe it's possible for us to have a free civil society in which both religious individuals and LGBT persons are allowed to live according to their identities and their deepest values, but this case will go a long way to determining whether that's actually what will happen. Before I get to the oral argument, which was fascinating this morning, I'd like to just make two or three quick points and then go through the facts and arguments quickly, and I hope I'm not too frustrating to people listening. Who really want to hear what happened. But I think this is important background. And first, when I talk about non-discrimination laws and religious freedom, I think it's always important to recognize the importance and the essential nature of non-discrimination laws in our society. We all know that our country has a shameful history of racism, based on the slavery and then the Jim Crow laws. And so anything I say should not be taken as a criticism of having non-discrimination laws generally. And indeed, going kind of to the theme of this morning about protecting religious freedom and keeping non-discrimination laws strong, I want to note that non-discrimination laws almost always protect religious persons. They're almost always a protected category. That's true for the federal public accommodations law, which is Title II in the Civil Rights Act of 64. Religion is one of the protected categories. And it's true of the 45 state public accommodation laws. Religion is protected in all 45 states' public accommodation laws. The other way in which we see religious freedom protected in non-discrimination laws is that they typically have some sort of religious exemption or protection that exempts some category of religious persons or institutions from the application of the law in some situations. And so I think it's a real red flag when, as is happening in this case, a non-discrimination law is actually being used to punish a person, a citizen, for living according to his or her deepest religious values. That's kind of a sign that something's maybe amiss here. And one of the themes of this morning was several of the justices kept asking the four oralists to help them find a way to protect religious individuals while at the same time not weakening non-discrimination laws in their normal application. As I already alluded to, this can be done. Unfortunately, the arguments made by the respondents, which I'll outline quickly in a minute, they outline this whole topic as a zero-sum game. Basically, under the the legal theory of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and the ACLU, which is representing the couple that wanted the wedding cake here. They claim this is a zero-sum game. Non-discrimination laws must always win at the expense of free speech and religious liberty. Jack Phillips' argument, on the other hand, is not that extreme. It's just that sometimes religious freedom and speech should be given accommodation under non-discrimination laws. And I'd just like to put a plug in at this point for the Christian Legal Society's brief that we filed in this case, which goes into more depth about how the court can come to a resolution in this case that honors the religious identities and the LGBT identities in this case. The brief was prepared by Doug Laycock and Tom Berg, who just did an excellent discussion on this point. And then, so I then want to move to what the facts of the case are, which I think probably everyone listening knows the facts well, but just to make sure we're at the same starting point because the facts are so important. Jack Phillips is the baker here, the cake artist. He discovered in high school that he loved art and he loved using his artistic talents in the context of creating and decorating cakes in a bakery. 24 years ago, he finally was able to set up his own bakery and named it Masterpiece Cake Shop because of a Bible verse in Ephesians that speaks of how we are God's workmanship or his masterpiece. He strives to run his business to honor God in accordance with his understanding of what the Bible teaches. He's not open on Sundays. He doesn't create cakes that contain alcohol or have derogatory messages about others. He does not create custom cakes for events that he believes are contrary to biblical teachings. He's turned down custom cakes for Halloween celebrations and divorce celebrations. And he does not design custom cakes for same-sex weddings, for any marriage other than between a man and a woman, because of his religious belief that many people share, that marriage is a sacred union between one man and one woman, and that the basic Christian understanding is that marriage is symbolic of the relationship of Jesus Christ with the church. In 2012, in July, a same-sex couple came into his shop and asked Phillips to create a cake for their wedding. He explained that he could not design a cake to celebrate a same-sex wedding, but that they were welcome to purchase anything pre-made in the bakery. The couple posted on left, they weren't happy, they posted online that he had declined their request, and that led to Phillips receiving calls threatening physical harm to him and his employees, as well as picketing and boycotts of his bakery. Another local baker provided the couple with a free rainbow-layered wedding cake. So they did get their cake, but Phillips was charged with violation of the Colorado civil rights laws when the couple filed a complaint of sexual orientation discrimination with the Civil Rights Commission. The ACLU represents the couple as interveners in the legal proceedings that the commission brought against Phillips. I want to note here, and in the oral argument, both the Chief Justice and Justice Alito raised this point, that in 2012, in Colorado, same-sex weddings were not legally recognized by the state, so that we have the strange situation of the state punishing Phillips for refusing to create a custom cake for a wedding that was not legally recognized by the state at the time. But this did not deter the commission from finding Phillips liable for sexual orientation discrimination. The commission ordered Phillips to cease creating wedding cakes for heterosexual weddings unless he also created cakes for same-sex weddings. It ordered him to train his staff, several of whom are his family members, regarding the requirements of the Colorado non-discrimination law, and to make quarterly compliance reports for 2 years to the government. In response, Philip ceased making custom wedding cakes, which accounted for approximately 40% of his income. That's 40. The bakery in 2012 had 10 employees. It now has 4 employees. I think that counts Phillips himself. Phillips appealed the commission's decision to the Colorado Court of Appeals, which affirmed the decision, and the Colorado Supreme Court denied review. But last year, as many of the listeners know, this case was relisted 14 times, but eventually the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, granted cert. I want to just quickly go over the arguments made in the briefs so that the discussion of the oral argument makes maybe a little more sense. So just quickly, Phillips made 2 main arguments in his briefs, and he largely relies upon a compelled speech argument under the free speech clause, of course, and that is that he's engaged in artistic expression when he creates his custom cakes. And for the government to force him to create artistic expression for an event, the wedding, that violates his religious conscience is compelled speech that's prohibited by the free speech clause. Freedom of speech, according to Phillips, prohibits the state from demanding that artists design custom expression that conveys ideas they deem objectionable. And the really important case, both relied upon by Phillips and the U.S. government, is Hurley versus Irish American Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Group of Boston that was decided by the court in 1995, in which the court held that a private parade in Boston, but it was a huge private parade, could exclude an LGBT contingent from the parade because their message was contrary to that the parade wanted to expressed. They could not be excluded because they were LGBT, but they could be excluded because the parade organizers objected to their message. There was also a second basic free speech argument, which is that there was some sort of content and viewpoint discrimination going on in this case, and the viewpoint discrimination is actually more relevant to the free exercise claim. And the content and viewpoint discrimination argument that Phillips made in his brief really wasn't a focus of the argument this morning. So besides the free speech argument, Phillips makes a free exercise argument, which is what we focused on in the CLS brief as well. And that has a couple of pieces. One is that Phillips is in essence being required to participate in a ceremony that he views as religious and having highly religious significance, and that he can't participate in due to his religious conscience. The second free exercise, as we all know, after the decision in Smith v. Employment Division, a general rule, but there are a lot of exceptions and limitations on the Smith decision, but generally, if a law is neutral and generally applicable, it can be applied to religious people without giving them an exception. Now, there are a lot of loopholes to that. But Phillips and our brief and others make a very strong case for the fact that that the non-discrimination law here, which, of course, on its face is neutral and generally applicable, has not been applied in a generally applicable and neutral manner, and that therefore violates the free exercise clause. It's essentially the main case for this is Lukumi from 1993. And there are 2 ways in which that argument spins out. One is that during the proceedings in the commission, a religious man approached 3 bakeries in the Denver area, which is where Phillips Bakery is. And he requested that they create a cake in the shape of a Bible with an anti-same-sex marriage message and a religious message on the cake. And all 3 bakeries turned him down. He then brought a complaint to the commission, which refused to bring charges and basically said that the 3 bakeries were within their right to refuse to create a cake with a message that offended the bakeries. Okay. Now, of course, Phillips is saying, I don't want to make a cake which sends a message that offends me, and charges were brought against him. So this is a key factor or fact in this case. And that would mean that the law was not being applied having general applicability and being applied neutrally. The second place where concern about the neutrality and general applicability arises is that during the commission's proceedings, there are seven commissioners, at least one and possibly two exhibited hostility to religion. One of the commissioners has basically very strong words against religion and about how it's used as a license to discriminate and a cover for racism. And we've all seen this argument made, but it was in the actual record and is in the petition at 293-94. Justice Kennedy actually really honed in on this fact and was deeply troubled by the fact that one of the commissioners might have found against Phillips because of the commissioner's hostility to religion. And Justice Kennedy specifically asked the Colorado Solicitor General, who's representing the commission, whether the commission had disapproved or disavowed the commissioner's statement. It had not, and Justice Kennedy asked the Solicitor General whether the state wanted to disapprove or disavow the commissioner's words. But the Solicitor General refused to agree that the commissioner's words showed bias, or that even if they were biased, that they tainted the entire proceeding with animus. But I think we see a window into Kennedy's thinking, which shows one way in which Phillips could win here on what would be basically an argument that he was being targeted because of his religious beliefs, did not receive a fair hearing because of bias by one of the commissioners, and it would be grounds for a Lukumi-type free exercise decision. So that's Phillips' arguments. Just very quickly, the Department of Justice, the U.S. government, filed in support of Phillips and had half of his argument time this morning. And its brief is making the same compelled speech argument, it didn't make a free exercise argument, that is narrower than that laid out in Phillips' main brief, but it's still along the same lines. And it's that the government can't force the creation of expression and the participation in an expressive event. So the two together, you have create the expression and you have participation in an expressive event. That a public accommodations law, which normally doesn't require First Amendment scrutiny, does receive heightened scrutiny when it compels both creation of expression and participation in an expressive event. And the Department of Justice also relied heavily on the Hurley decision, and it gave quite a bit of attention as to how limited this accommodation for Phillips would be, that most commercial transactions wouldn't satisfy the threshold requirement that the product or service be communicative or expressive, that it would not apply to pre-made goods, only custom. And that many public accommodations laws, but certainly not all and certainly not Colorado's, do not regulate commissioned expressive businesses. And the DOJ also went into why this is different than race-based discrimination. Just briefly, I'll turn to the basic arguments for the ACLU and the commission in their briefs. They basically argue that there's no protection here for Phillips. Expression. It's commercial. It's conduct, not compelled speech. Even if it's expression, that's only an incidental restriction, and it's not a restriction that's aimed at the suppression of expression, and therefore either the scrutiny should either be rational basis or at most the O'Brien burning the draft card case test. Of course, the ACLU and the state claim that there's always a compelling interest in preventing discrimination, no matter how weak the discrimination claim is and no matter how strong, you know, the First Amendment claim might be. Those are my words, not theirs, but that is what they're claiming and what they maintained this morning. And that even if it is, this is narrowly tailored, and if you allow Jack Phillips to be accommodated. Bakers will refuse to make cakes for interfaith and interracial marriages. This is a very extreme argument, but it's a very common argument. I just would note here that one of the big emphasis in this argument is that it's on commercial speech, that somehow commercial is different, which seems intuitive. But we know from other earlier cases that the argument isn't limited to commercial speech, that in cases like Boy Scouts Fidel, CLS v. Martinez, which involved a religious student group's membership and leadership requirements, Dell, which was the Boy Scouts membership and leadership requirements, and Hosanna Tabor, which involved a religious school, when a non-discrimination law is involved, there's always the argument that it either covers non-commercial organizations or that, like in Hosanna Tabor, the religious school is commercial because it charges students tuition. This was brilliantly, in my opinion, demonstrated by Chief Justice Roberts this morning in his opening question to the Colorado Solicitor General when he asked whether the Colorado non-discrimination law would require a Catholic legal services organization to provide legal services to a same-sex couple wanting to sue Jack Phillips for not providing a wedding cake to celebrate their wedding. He returned to this question more than once. And, of course, if this is only about commercial businesses, then that should have been the easy answer. Oh, no, that's not a commercial organization. The Catholic Legal Services is a religious nonprofit. But the answer was that Catholic Legal Services organization would have to provide the same services to the couple as provided to others. So now I'll turn more to a description of the oral argument this morning. First, in case I didn't already say this, I got there at 5:45 and it was already a question of whether I'd get in the courtroom. So there was quite a buzz this morning. It was an excellent oral argument by the people presenting the argument, as well as the justices were really grappling with the issues in largely a helpful way. So there were four advocates this morning at the podium. First was Kristen Wagner of Alliance Defending Freedom on behalf of Jack Phillips. Sharing her time, 15 minutes of her time, was the Solicitor General Noel Francisco on behalf of the U.S. government in support of Phillips. Respondents were represented by Fred Yarger, Solicitor General of Colorado, who argued on behalf of the Respondent Commission, and he was followed by David Cole of the ACLU for the respondent couple. And now I'm just going to walk through kind of how the questioning went to give you a flavor, and then hopefully we can open for questions. So Wagner was up first for Phillips, and both Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy just began questioning immediately, asking why Phillips would not refuse to sell pre-made cakes to a same-sex couple if they were his artistic expression. So why are pre-made cakes not the same artistic expression as the custom cakes? But she explained that they were expression, but they'd already been created. So he wouldn't be being compelled to create expression, which would be the case if he were required to create a custom cake. And the important thing about this exchange is that both Justice Kennedy and Ginsburg nailed down the fact that Phillips is very willing to sell pre-made cakes to one and all, everyone, just not custom cakes for events that he cannot agree to in good conscience, and that there's a rationale for this distinction. Then Justice Ginsburg asked a question that would become important during respondents' arguments. She suggested that Phillips should have to do a custom cake for one and all, as long as he did not have to write a message on it that he disagreed with. Because one of the facts in the case is there's not an actual written message, or as far as we know, he wasn't being requested to write an actual written message on the cake. But this came up again toward the end of the oral argument in the ACLU's argument time, when Justice Ginsburg tried to draw this line, only to learn that the ACLU's position is that Phillips would have to write a message on the cake for a same-sex couple if he would write it on the cake for a heterosexual couple. Justice Ginsburg's hypothetical to the ACLU was whether Phillips would have to write, "God bless this union of John and Mark," on a same-sex couple's wedding cake if he had earlier written, "God bless this union of John and Mary," on a heterosexual couple's cake. And she did not seem to expect the ACLU's answer to be yes. He would have to write both, but that was the answer given. Again, during Wagner's time, Justice Kagan went through a list of wedding vendors to determine whether every wedding vendor qualifies as creating expression for a wedding. The florist, yes, according to Wagner. Invitation printer, yes. The jeweler, maybe. The hair, no. The makeup artist, no. Justice Kagan pressed Wagner on why some was expression, especially the makeup artist, and some was not, and how to draw that line. Wagner had good answers. Sotomayor then asked when the court had ever protected food. She also explained that the expression was the customer's expression, not Phillips. Justice Alito asked whether architectural designs were protected, but when Wagner responded in the negative, Justice Breyer was frustrated that Michelangelo would not be protected, but Phillips would be. And Breyer kept coming back to the fact that the court was looking for lines to draw to protect speech without protecting everything, you know, without taking everything out of the non-discrimination law's strength. Wagner offered the test from Hurley of whether this is speech or communication, and is the individual being compelled to speak objecting to the message or a class of persons. That became a theme in the argument. And at the end of Wagner's time, Sotomayor and Kagan both asked about interracial weddings and interfaith weddings, and Wagner explained that race is different because there the objection is to the person, not the message, and that the eradication of racial discrimination has always been a compelling interest. Justice Gorsuch asked for help for how to draw the line between when the objection is to the message and not to the person, but Wagner's time was up. The Solicitor General then got up for his 15 minutes. He began by following the brief's arguments that this is just a narrow accommodation, which the Department of Justice had outlined so well in its brief. Justice Ginsburg asked him to define how narrow it was, to explain how narrow it was. Justice Kennedy expressed concern that so many services can claim to be speech, so how do we know when they really should be entitled to speech protection? Justice Kennedy also asked whether the baker could put a sign in the window stating no custom cakes for gay weddings, and he noted his concern about the dignitary harms that the LGBT customers had. Justice Sotomayor asked about same-sex couples wanting to get married on an isolated military base, and the SG noted that that would probably be a time when the denial of access or the lack of practical access would be mean that the government had a compelling interest in possibly overriding the First Amendment rights there. And the Solicitor General made a point that I thought was very useful, that going back to Hurley, that this was actually a worse case than Hurley because here the government was essentially forcing an objector to actually march in a parade to which he objected and not just include a small contingent of people in a parade. Justice Ginsburg then asked whether race was in its own category and then what about gender and national origin. And Justice Kagan gave a helpful insight into how she was thinking about the case by saying that she saw the case as having what she termed three axes. The first axis, who else is covered, is the baker is, the chef, the hairstylist, the makeup artist. The second axis is why are LGBT people in a different category from race or, in her view, less protected if this accommodation is given. And then her third axis was why just protect religious beliefs in the wedding context? What about other religious ceremonies like a bar mitzvah? Justice Kagan asked, what if a great chef does not create dinner for gay couples celebrating their anniversary? The Solicitor General said that would not be speech. Justice Alito elicited one of the few laughters during the oral argument. There were a few others, but when he revealed that he does not get to go to five-star restaurants like his colleagues, and so he's not real familiar with how they work, but would he be allowed to bring a recipe with him and demand that the chef cook that for him? And, of course, the answer was no. And then Justice Gorsuch did say at the end of the SG's argument that he would like to see a better test than that the government had offered, which I don't should not be taken as Justice Gorsuch being unhappy with the government's argument, but just asking for additional help. And that's, again, what most of the justices were asking. How do we draw these lines? Breyer asked how to limit an opinion in favor of Phillips, and Kennedy asked whether bakers might be encouraged by national organizations to boycott same-sex weddings if Phillips won. I think the SG's response that this would raise questions of access and a possible compelling interest is correct, but I also think everyone recognizes, including Justice Kennedy, that this isn't really a realistic concern, particularly when one looks at the lineup of amicus in support of respondents. So I'm going to turn very quickly to how the arguments went for the respondents. As I've already said, when the Colorado Solicitor General stood up to begin an argument, the Chief Justice immediately asked him about this Catholic Legal Services hypothetical. Would they have to provide, would they have to represent a same-sex couple suing Jack Phillips, even though that violated their religious beliefs? And he got a troubling but accurate answer, which is basically under Colorado law, yes, they would. Kennedy then asked the question, which I alluded to earlier, about whether the state was going to disavow or disapprove of the commissioner's hostility to religion, and that, I think, is going to be a very critical question, and did not get an answer that was satisfactory. I mean, it's clear that they're not disavowing that statement, and they don't see that that was bias. Breyer says that many non-discrimination laws have exceptions that try to minimize harm to the protected classes while minimizing harm to other people as well. Is that just the legislature's job? And then he interestingly said, Colorado doesn't seem to have tried to do this, which I think is a very hopeful sign that the court, Breyer and Kennedy especially, are looking for a way to protect both sets of interests here. Alito then brought in this disturbing record of possible religious targeting because of the three bakers turning down the offensive anti-same-sex marriage marriage message, and that, but not being charged with discrimination by the commission, but Phillips being forced to provide a pro-same-sex marriage message in what looks like to be the same context. The Solicitor General for Colorado tried the argument that the three bakers are rejecting the message regardless of the person, but this triggered from Kennedy a very interesting set of three declarative sentences, and I don't have the exact quote of the transcripts, probably already out, but basically what Kennedy said is tolerance is essential in a free society, and mutual tolerance is crucial. Colorado has not been tolerant of Phillips here. And I think that's coming from Justice Kennedy. That, again, is a hopeful sign, like the Breyer comment, that Colorado just doesn't seem to have tried to accommodate both the religious concerns and the LGBT. The Chief Justice asked, does it matter that same-sex marriage was not legal in 2012, Yarger says no. Alito says it's very odd that it won't recognize same-sex marriage, but the baker's punished for not selling a same-sex wedding cake. Alito also makes the point that summary judgment was at issue here, so the facts should be taken as most favorable to Phillips. Alito then said, would Phillips have to put words on a cake? If he puts words on a cake for some, would he have to put it on for all? And the answer from the Solicitor General of Colorado was yes. And Alito uses an example of what if someone wants the date November 9th on a cake because it's their anniversary, but then someone else wants November 9th on the cake because they're celebrating Hitler's Kristallnacht? And the Solicitor General did not have a good answer for that. And then Gorsuch, in one of the more interesting questions, I think important questions, said, why isn't the retraining that Phillips is required to retrain his staff, which includes family members? Gorsuch says, why isn't the retraining compelled speech, which it seems obvious it is, and a free exercise violation? And Yarger's only response is, well, this is a common remedy in discrimination situations. Gorsuch says, but it compels Phillips to teach against his religious beliefs. Yarger says he only has to teach what the law requires or what compliance requires. But Kennedy comes in and says, but he has to teach against his religious beliefs. Ginsburg tries to rescue Yarger and say, no, he's just having to say what the law says he, you know, is required. But that's how the Solicitor General of Colorado's argument ended, and it was a very troubling argument. Just quickly, David Cole for the ACLU basically staked out the same extreme position as the Colorado government. The highlights of that were, at one point, the Chief Justice read the passage from Obergefell that refers to religious people being decent and honorable in their opposition to same-sex marriage. And he reads that and he says, you know, doesn't Obergefell mean that we don't lump religious dissent to same-sex marriage with racism? Breyer asks if someone could be hired and forced to come to a wedding and say helpful things. I think he's kind of thinking of a singer or someone like that. And this is where Ginsburg asked her question about God bless the union of John and Mark and John and Mary. And I'm using those names. I couldn't hear the exact name she used. And basically, Cole said, well, maybe we need an exception for actual physical presence, but he didn't really have that spelled out. And he answered Ginsburg's question, yes, the baker has to write those words if he's written them for others. Kagan jumps in to rescue him and says, do we have to answer that question? He says, no. But Kennedy was clearly troubled by the possibility that physical presence could be compelled. And Cole really, Breyer again is asking for help, and Cole's just saying it's not possible to give exceptions. Alito asks, are words on cake expression? And Cole says, no, they're conduct, not speech. And he just kept holding out that this was not speech, it was conduct, which I think frustrated the justices. And I think at that point, I'll end with saying that there was a little more with Cole's, but I'll end with saying that Kristen Wagner gave an excellent rebuttal, and it will be very interesting to see what the court does with this case. Laura?
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any audience questions yet, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 6th at 2 p.m. That call will be on regulatory federalism and will feature Paul Watkins, Civil Litigation Division Chief at the Office of the Arizona Attorney General. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, thanks very much for your excellent presentation. My name's Laura Peterson. Wanted to ask two questions, please. First, if you could say something about Wagner's rebuttal, and then second, if you could comment on whether freedom of association was raised by any of the justices.
Okay, I'll take the second question first, and that is that it wasn't raised. And I could be wrong on this, but I think it actually was not a claim made in this case. I'm pretty sure of that, that it was not part of the First Amendment claims made. As to the rebuttal, Sotomayor was asking repeatedly, who decides for a corporation, what its position is. Wagner answered, this is the Phillips owns masterpiece. She then urges the court to look at the Doug Laycox brief, the CLS brief, for more on why the fact that the three bakers, when they rejected the cake, making the cake with an anti-same-sex marriage message, why that was not okay if Jack was being forced to bake a pro-same-sex marriage case. And she outlined a few quick answers to that, but referred to our brief on that when Justice Ginsburg asked her during rebuttal about that. She reemphasized that Phillips has served everyone in his bakery and he declines other cakes for other events that violate his religious conscience. And she just ended with noting that everyone knows that cultural shifts have occurred, but that we should not shift, our culture or our legal culture should not shift on its dedication to the principle that government should not compel people to express themselves in a way to which they object.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any audience questions, I'll ask one of my own. Were there any surprises of the oral argument for you?
Well, for me, the main surprise is just a procedural one, but the Chief Justice gave extra time to just a few minutes extra to Kristen Wagner and then to the SG, and he gave the same amount of time extra to the respondents, so that the argument actually went almost an hour and 20 minutes. And actually, that was really nice because, of course, there were a lot more questions that could have been asked and answered, but it meant that you kind of felt like the basic arguments were able to get out there. I've seen arguments where there are so many questions that the advocate is not really allowed to get his full answer out or her full answer out. And I think here they really were given a pretty fair opportunity to make their case.
We have six audience questions lined up now, so let's go to that first call.
Hi, this is Phil Goldstein. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the call, but it always seems to me that in this type of case that they spend too much time on trying to determine what's speech, what's not speech, is a religious objection different than just an objection for any other reason. And it seems to me that the greater issue is basically can the government compel you to create something for whatever reason that you don't want to do it. And it seems to me that this actually is whether it's speech or non-speech or a cake or fixing your car, it doesn't matter. It's involuntary servitude, which is, I think, prohibited by the Constitution. And I wonder if that, you know, it sort of seems to be the subtext of many of the comments that I've heard. And I just wondered what you think about that. Can somebody just be forced to provide a service that they don't want to do for whatever reason to somebody?
Well,
like, for example, when the dress designers didn't want to produce a gown for Melania Trump, could there be a law that would require them to do that?
So just on the last piece, in D.C., part of the non-discrimination law is that you can't discriminate on the basis of political, I think it's belief, I'm not sure. And so at the time of the inauguration, there was a serious question, I think, of whether that might be violated by the number of service providers who, you know, were saying they would not provide a service for the inauguration. So, you know, that's how non-discrimination laws might line up there. Most do not involve political speech or belief. But I think on the bigger question, I think the real answer is that because of the history of racism and segregation, slavery in this country, we have given we've not gone down that route. We've said yes, there are a number of times, many ways, in which a business can be forced to provide a service or a product that it might not want to, and we have to, because otherwise, you know, that because segregation was so deeply entrenched, both in law and in culture, you know, otherwise the non-discrimination laws at the time wouldn't have worked. But we're in a very different culture on this type of issue, of course. It's the religious dissenter who's the minority and who's being suppressed, not the LGBT people. And I think we see that in the lineup of amicus briefs in support of the respondent. So I think, you know, we left that argument behind a long time ago about involuntary servitude, and we did so for a reason. But that reason isn't applicable here because, you know, the culture is very different.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for the excellent summary. Just curious if you know the fruit of the tree here. There's some pretty crazy fruit coming off this tree. It seems to stem back from the fundamental misstep that the court took in Obergefell as a matter of law and jurisprudence. Wholly aside from what you think about the, you know, the policy issue and the same-sex marriage pros and cons, et cetera. Was there any suggestion that you got from the questioning that any of the justices are realizing what a dead end, or you know, pick your metaphor, that the court has steered itself down only relatively recently in Obergefell, such that we're now having these crazy discussions about bakers making cakes and whether they customize the cake or the message or the icing, et cetera, and whether that's art, et cetera. It just seems like, you know, that old adage, when the answers start coming back really wacky, there's something wrong with the question.
Right. So, no, I don't think there was any hint during the argument that any of the justices, I mean, the four dissenters, you know, they wouldn't have said this, but I don't think there was any hint that any of the justices were trying to undermine or change Obergefell. I do think in at least the Chief Justice's quote from Obergefell, and I know a number of the briefs in support of the petitioner, I do think a lot of people, including the Chief Justice, are saying, did you mean what you said in Obergefell about religious people not needing to be worried about their First Amendment rights if same-sex marriage is the law of the land? And so in this In that way, this really is not a challenge to Obergefell, but a request to fulfill what the court seemed to promise religious people in Obergefell, that they would not be suppressed or harassed because of their religious beliefs.
Let's go to our next caller.
This is Chuck Schreffler. Thank you, Kim. This has been really interesting. I'm kind of wondering, you said the justices were kind of struggling with where to draw the lines or balance the interests. I'm wondering if you got any sense from the questions about where you think they're leaning in terms of that balancing?
I should have a sense, but I don't have a good sense of where they would lean. I do think I basically think we could see a decision along the lines of this religious targeting that greatly concerned Justice Kennedy, that is reinforced by not just the commissioner's comments, but by the commission's treatment of the three bakeries that refused to make another cake. I think that's a very possible means, but that would be free exercise, and I like that. That's what our brief was about. But I was struck by the fact that the argument really stayed largely centered around the compelled speech question. So I think there's a very good chance that we'll see a decision that says, yes, Phillips is engaged in expressive speech, that it's only in the context of a custom product or service. It's only in the context of where that product or service is readily available to the declined couple. And it's maybe even only in the context, as the Department of Justice argues, where you have both the creative expression and the participation in an event. So I think even though Gorsuch said he'd like more from the Department of Justice on this, I think that may be where we see an opinion if it comes out on speech grounds.
Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Miriam Moore. Thank you very much for the summary. I was wondering, when I was started to think about this case, it reminded me in some ways of the nude dancing cases that the Supreme Court did, I think, the last 1990s. Was there any mention, because in those cases there was a lot of discussion of expressive conduct, and what about the dance that the exotic dancer was doing constituted speech or conduct that was conveying a message? Was there any discussion of that during the oral argument?
There wasn't. I mean, the main discussion, just centered around wedding vendors and that type of where they would draw the line between the hairstylist and the baker. I don't think, quite honestly, except with the exception of Justice Sotomayor, there wasn't a lot of pushback on the fact that Jack Phillips' creation of these cakes was expression. And that may be due not only to the fact that speech has been fairly broadly defined, but also anything on the internet about the story, you just can't come away from watching about what Phillips does without being so impressed by his artistic abilities, especially from someone who can't draw a straight line like me. I'm very impressed. And I just wanted to note here, there's the Daily Signal, which is a heritage publication, had an excellent piece on just showing how Phillips works. It's about 8-minute long video. On November 29th, if you want to watch that and hear him give his story, it's a really kind of inspiring 8 minutes.
We have another caller on the line.
Yes, hi. This is Darren Bax calling. Thank you for the presentation. Just a quick question. Whether or not, and this kind of gets to the compelled speech issue, whether or not the justices were focusing at all on whether or not if the cake itself was kind of neutral, whether or not that made a difference. In other words, if the cake in no way could suggest, didn't have writing or didn't have a man and a man on top, or just basically make me a customized cake, but it's just very neutral. Nobody could tell anything about the views of the baker. Did they kind of look at that issue?
Right. So to the degree that anyone seemed, at least was asking questions along those lines, it was Justice Ginsburg. So early on, Ginsburg and Kennedy asked Wagner, you know, if making cakes is expression, why aren't the pre-made cakes, which he says he'll sell to anybody, why aren't they expression, and he doesn't want to sell them either to a same-sex couple? And Wagner did an excellent job of explaining why that was already expression he'd made. He wasn't being compelled to make it, so he had no problem with just selling it to whoever wanted it. It's when he's sitting down and saying, what do you want for your wedding cake, that Phillips will not make them for a same-sex wedding. Now, to your question, Ginsburg was exploring that, and I think that's why, just reading her mind, which is very hard to do, I think she might have been tempted to go down that road of saying, well, this is just, you know, a nicely decorated, artistically decorated cake, but it doesn't have words, so it's not expression. But, you know, the answer from both the state of Colorado and the ACLU was, yeah, we can force them to put the words on, too. And I don't, you know, I never will predict how Justice Ginsburg votes, but I think it's clear she was not expecting that answer and that that was a deeply troubling answer to her.
Looks like we have another caller in line.
Yes, good afternoon. Stephen Casey here, and thank you for doing the call. My question is this, the weight of it going versus free religion versus free speech, and I don't ever see this kind of addressed, is that there's a fundamental difference between the speech model and the religion model, because, you know, in the religion model, there's this idea of transcendent values, whereas in the speech model, you know, functionally, speech just kind of bounces off the ceiling. You don't really have to have an idea of any type of transcendence. And in the previous cases, all the justices have lined up basically like their ideological predecessors on Hobby Lobby was 5-4, Gonzales v. Carhart was 5-4, and those were both, you know, all life cases with that transcendence. But when you got into free speech, on McCollum v. Coakley, it was 9-0. So do you see it that the justices might split along kind of ideological lines and be 5-4 on the religion issue, but then all come down pretty much in a large majority on the speech side of the question?
I think, you know, that could be what the thinking is. I think if they do that, I would think that they probably won't go to the religion issue and they'll just stay on the free speech. But if they're having a lot of trouble on the free speech coming to a consensus, the religious targeting may be where they coalesce a majority. So I came out of it thinking they could go either way, either religion or speech. But I think probably if there's actually a majority for both, they'll go with the speech. That's just a guess.
Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you for your presentation, Kim. And as one of the earlier callers suggested, my name is George Weaver, by the way. It seems like in Obergefell, 2.5 years ago, the court has created basically open Pandora's box here, and now we have this collision of rights that would have been hard to predict, perhaps. In any event, I understood you to say that the state of Colorado and the ACLU argued to the court today that a public interest religious law firm could be forced to sue Jack Phillips for alleged violation of civil rights. And so that raises the question of whether if Mr. Phillips can be forced to deliver a message with which he disagrees that other professional people, like say an architect asked to draw plans for a gay bar, or a conservative attorney, maybe not a public interest attorney, could be forced to handle a same-sex divorce. In both those cases, it would seem that the professional could regard the activity as endorsement of something with which he or she disagrees.
Right.
Do you see, is that the real argument presented here by the state of Colorado and ACLU?
Yes. I mean, there. If you're offering a commercial service to the public, if you're getting paid, now I'm extracting or extrapolating, but you know, you are engaged in conduct, not speech. That was at least my takeaway from their responses to the court this morning, and you know, that raises the issues you're raising. One piece, I felt like I was violating the Eighth Amendment there when I was starting off on what the ACLU's argument was, and I thought we should just get to questions. But I didn't include a piece where Alito asked the ACLU attorney whether Colorado can compel a religious college to provide married housing to same-sex couples as well as heterosexual couples, or hold same-sex weddings in its chapel. And Cole said, Hosanna Tabor may have exceptions for churches. Well, that's the ministerial exception. I mean, that's, you know, that doesn't directly apply to what Alito was asking him. And Alito said, this is not a church. And Cole just says, Employment Division v. Smith says there would be no free exercise claim. So it's a very extreme position that they're taking, even as to, you know, what we'd normally consider a religious college as a religious nonprofit. So
we're up on the hour, but we have a few more questions left. Let's go to our last two questions.
Hi, Kim. It's Brandon Smith. It's good to hear you give an update on this. There's been a lot of coverage in kind of the conservative legal media world that there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding of the facts of the case. I know probably notably George Will and David French have kind of gotten into it. I was wondering if you felt that the court had a good understanding of some of the more nuanced facts. It sounds like they did. And to what extent do you think the accurate view of the facts of what's happened and what could happen might play in determining how they apply the law in this situation?
I think that they had, overall, the justices had a very good grasp of the facts. It was clear from the briefing that the position was that if Phillips were asked to put words on the cake, he would have to put them on. And so maybe Justice Ginsburg, you know, hadn't quite caught that. Justice Sotomayor asked a question at the very beginning of Wagner's argument where she made some factual statements that I didn't write down, so take this with a grain of salt, but at the time I was thinking she doesn't have the facts right, so I'll need to go back and look at that. So there were a couple of times where I thought, but by and large, I thought the court really had a good handle on the arguments and on the facts, and that, of course, bodes well for, you know, the possibility of a good decision here, because the facts are very much in support of Jack Phillips.
And with that, let's go to our last question.
This is John Cunniff at Han Loescher & Parks. Thanks for your presentation, Kim. I was curious if the Supreme Court's decision in the recent Tam case came up, Tam being the case that struck down a prohibition of registration of so-called offensive trademarks, based at least in part on a government entity deciding what was or was not offensive. Did Tam come up at all?
It did not come up in the oral argument, but it did come up in the briefing and in the context that you're noting. which is that it's a very strong rejection of the idea that government can decide what messages are and are not offensive, which is exactly what the Colorado Commission did with the various bakery cakes that it was were complained about. So yes, in the briefing it came up, but not in the oral argument.
Would you like to make any closing remarks?
No, I just thank everyone for their patience in sticking out the hour, and I would say that everything I said was from handwritten notes, so the transcript I think is probably out now, and so if you have time, you know, go through and read the transcript so you can see for yourself. I don't want to have conveyed any false impressions of what the justices did and didn't say. So, but it was a very engaging argument. It's worth listening to when it comes out on Friday as well.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Kim for the benefit of her valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.